Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, to another live episode of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We really appreciate everybody taking some time out of your day to join us for an hour-long discussion. And if you're with that elite group that joins us live, if you want to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show in order to see what questions y'all might have or observations y'all might have that we want to fold into the show as it moves forward. And if you got to take off during the course of the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And now we're going to go ahead and jump back in to today's show and the subject at hand. And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about one of the more intriguing maritime security-related issues that's popped above the ambient noise here this year. And that is the role of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, are playing in the ongoing crisis in the Mediterranean Sea, as we've seen wave after wave of refugees and migrants, both economic and otherwise, who are risking what few financial resources they have in their lives to get out of mostly sub-Saharan Africa and getting into Europe. We're going to talk about what they're doing, not so much the migrants per se, as those NGOs that have gotten themselves involved in, depending upon your point of view, either assisting the migrants or assisting in the migrants making their way to Europe. We're going to look at what some of the goals of the governments are, the international organizations, traditional NGOs, and also some of the new NGO players that have come on the scene. And we've brought on today two great guests and returning guests to Midrats to discuss this topic. And we're going to use as a baseline their two-part series that they published, part one over War on the Rocks and part two on Sinset. And that would be Claude Berrabay and Chris Rawley. Claude, he's the director of the Naval Academy Museum and is a lieutenant commander in the Naval Reserve. He is a hopefully even more prolific author, most recently of the Connor Stark series of books, The Aden Effect, that came out in 2012 from Naval Institute Press, and also from Naval Institute Press in 2015, Siren Song. He has a BA in History and Soviet Studies and an MA in History from Northeastern University. He also has a master's in national security studies from the Naval War College. He's also currently working all of his time when he's not on Midrats, working on his doctoral dissertation through the University of Leeds on Andrew Jackson's Navy. Chris is a commander in the Naval Reserve, where he is the commanding officer of a reserve unit that focuses on building partnerships to enhance maritime security in the Gulf of Guinea. He's also the founder and CEO of an agricultural investing company, Harvest Returns, and serves on the board of directors for the Center for International Maritime Security. And just as a disclaimer, I'll do on behalf of Claude and Chris, they're on here today just speaking for themselves. Their views and opinions do not necessarily represent the United States Naval Reserve, United States Navy, or any organizations that they may be a party to. Claude and Chris, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sal. Glad to be back.
Just this is one of those topics that, for those that aren't familiar with a long form format, an hour seems like a long time. It's not, especially for a topic like this. You can just go on for a long time. And having both of y'all on here with both of your backgrounds, I think is going to bring a nice perspective to it. And I thought for the listener, and Claude, I would like to go ahead and roll this to you to kick things off, is kind of set the table for us for the Mediterranean, because since recorded time, that inland sea has always seemed to produce more history that can be consumed locally. And it has in its background lawlessness. Caesar was taken prisoner by pirates as a young man. And for those that aren't familiar to the story, I would encourage those people to read it, so you really know what going Roman means when it comes to pirates. And of course, an area of scholastic study for you, Claude, the U.S. Navy cut its teeth on the pirates in the Mediterranean, specifically from North Africa. And throughout that time, the nations that have bordered the Mediterranean have, when they're not trading with each other, their citizens have been smuggling things from one direction to another. In the last few years, we saw it really come as a factor during the Syrian civil war, but it's morphed into a few different iterations. Human trafficking coming into Europe, just a huge amount of people. And if you could flesh out for the listener the state of play here in 2017 when it comes to the migrant crisis in Europe.
Sure. And just to clarify those points, I mean, piracy in the Mediterranean was with us. Thucydides mentions piracy in his History of the Peloponnesian War.
Yep.
You see the great migrations, even in the book you recommended, Sal, Carthage Must Die, a great book about that period. But there's so many books about the Mediterranean because so many world powers at the time came out of that. The I go back to about a decade when my then colleague Robert Kaplan spoke to us at the Academy, and he talked about three great migrations that were going to be happening in this century. The first was all of them were south to north, south to Central America to North America, China to Eastern Russia, and the great migration from North Africa to Europe, all of which would fundamentally change what we know. And I think that's playing out right now. In fact, we are seeing tactical results of really tectonic plate shifts of population movements, if you will. You know, earthquakes and volcanoes happen when tectonic plates shift, and that's what we're seeing the migrant issue in the Mediterranean. And it's so important. I mean, you go back to Rome, as you mentioned, that Rome was so dependent on the wheat from Egypt. So what we're seeing now, and I'll let Chris talk about what has come up the past couple of years, but Europe is changing very quickly, and that has come by and large from the immigration of cheap labor in Germany, France, Italy and elsewhere, which are they're not simply repopulating; they're at population levels for the native population. So we're seeing a displacement in the next century demographically, and as a result, you're going to have conflicts. So one of the things one of the ways it's manifested itself is with this migration from Libya to Italy, because that's the shortest route from north to, from south to north, with the exception of the Straits of Gibraltar. And as a result, you have political movements who view the governments as not upholding what they are supposed to do. For example, with the search and rescue NGOs, they are moving and trying to rescue refugees because they don't believe that the states in the EU are doing enough. You have the counter movement with the Defend Europe, who has now sent a ship called the Sea Star, and it is now patrolling, if you will, off of Libya because it sees the EU governments as not doing enough in terms of border control. So it's sort of like the Minutemen down in the American Southwest. So now you have this challenge from both sides of the organization, and that's the very rough setup, and I'll let Chris talk about how the NGOs themselves develop down there.
Sure. Thanks, Claude. Yeah, I want a little more recent history. There's always been this flow of African migrants across the shorter parts of the Med. That's between Tangiers and Gibraltar, and then Libya, Tripoli, and Italy. And some of this migration is also more recently coming from the Syrian conflict, and it's going through Turkey and Greece. But around 2010, 2011, what happened was we deposed Gaddafi down there, and he had kept a lid on it, and that kind of opened the doors to a larger amount of migration. So you look at this vacuum, the first vacuum being that Libyan authority keeping people from leaving their shores. And several groups sprang up around 2013-14, starting with a group called MOAS, Migrant Offshore Aid Station. Medicine Sans Frontier at Sea is also helping in about seven or eight other groups. And together they operate 15 or 16 ships. So these ships have operated both up closer to Italy and lately in the past couple of years closer to Tripoli. And that takes us to the events of the past couple of weeks where there's been a lot of back and forth. The state gets a vote in this. So there's a number of parties involved besides just the NGOs. There's, of course, the states, the countries in the northern Med, Italy, Greece, and then there's also what remains of Libyan government, which is right now sort of bifurcated into two groups, roughly based along the east and the west. And those groups, along with the EU, or those countries, along with the EU, which has had a mission, Operation Sophia and Frontier, to do counter-smuggling, counter-human trafficking, not so much the migrant rescue, but, of course, like any mariner, they're going to rescue somebody they see out at sea. So that has gone back and forth, and as they've approached closer to the Med coast, the Libyan Coast Guard has become more involved. Up until the past two days or so, basically the Libyan Coast Guard kicked, started firing warning shots and getting more and more aggressive ever since the springtime, and pushing these NGOs back until most of them have kind of have pulled out of the area, with the exception of the one that Claude mentioned earlier. I think it's the ship Aquarius being tailed by SeaStar, and that's where we are today.
Well, we're talking enormous numbers of people since this current Mediterranean migration began. I mean, I think I saw one of your articles that were over 1 million, and they're looking forward to possibly 30 million people migrating from Africa into Europe. And looking at the demographics, as I did in one of my blog posts, you know, as you said, it started out with a pretty large number of Syrian immigrants, but now the numbers seem to be from many, you know, Bangladesh, Cote d'Ivory, Eritrea. The whole complexion of the migration has changed. How, you know, a group like Defend Europe, you know, are they has commonly announced some kind of alt-right, you know, anti-migration group, or are they just people looking to bring some kind of order into this chaos?
Yeah, I actually spoke to Defend Europe as well as some other SAR NGOs in the past couple of weeks about this. Everybody will say that Defend Europe is part of identity generation in Europe, this new alt-right movement. They have said on different occasions that they were against the migration. Now, they're focused primarily now on human trafficking. There's been some validation with that in the past week, with Italy stopping one of the maritime NGOs in Sicily. I think it was, Chris, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just not sure how large a group it is. For example, the SeaStar itself probably has 5 to 8 people I've seen aboard with the blue Defend Europe ships. They've raised a little over 200K, not a lot in terms of conducting a seasonal campaign. Chris and I talk about this, that, you know, that might help you for a couple of weeks for fuel and labor and the ship, but not much more. They've suggested that it's enough to get them going, as well as potentially start up ideas for two subsequent missions. But I've spoken to other maritime NGOs, not the ones that we're talking about today, and they said, yeah, it's 2 to 3 times that much easily for a campaign at sea that goes 2 or 3 months. So I can't imagine that they're going to be staying at sea much longer. It depends how many much supplies they took, for example. And another issue that Defend Europe has is the whole issue of rescuing. They have told me that they intend to notify MRCC Rome when a ship is in distress. But the question then becomes, how much do they have on board to prepare for that? Do they have doctors aboard or medically qualified staff? Do they have life vests and food and water for all these people? When I asked them specifically on those issues, they said, yeah, the first thing they said, yes, we've got hundreds of life vests aboard. I'm just not sure how much the Sea Star was kitted out when she left Djibouti. Keep in mind, Sea Star is a former private maritime security vessel. It was a floating armory in the Red Sea. And I just don't know how prepared it is. I've seen the videos that Defend Europe has shown below decks. What I would really like to see are their reefers to see how much material they do have for emergency situations. And I think what's unfortunate is I asked them, do you have an embedded reporter aboard? And they were really hesitant about having any other media. They wanted to do the media themselves. But I think in this case, it would have lent itself to a great deal of transparency had they had someone aboard. It didn't have to be somebody from, say, any left-wing paper. It could have been somebody from a right-wing paper, just anybody aboard to really see what they're doing and ask questions. Chris?
Yeah, you talked about the informational piece of that, Claude, and this is really important. There's been a lot of, I guess like in any regular conflict, there's a lot of information, disinformation on both sides, and the truth's probably somewhere in the middle. So there's been accusations from the rescue NGOs that this is the Libyan Coast Guard has been accosting immigrants and things like that, or the migrants, and I'm sure that's probably true. There's been accusations from some of the right-wing groups that these ships have been basically taking the migrants directly out of the hands of the smugglers and then letting the rafts go back to the coast of Libya to pick up another group. So they're essentially aiding and abetting the human traffickers. And there was actually one of the ships from one of the German NGOs was detained briefly, I believe, by the Libyan Coast Guard for just that accusation. So we shouldn't dismiss the informational piece of it on all sides. And it's just interesting. You know, one of the a rough rule of thumb I like to see is on Twitter, how many followers each of these groups has. And it's interesting to Defend Europe. Following has it doesn't necessarily connotate support, but it's skyrocketed up to the same size, close to 19,000 followers as some of the other NGOs that have been doing this on the rescue side. So that's just a little factoid.
Yeah, and just to follow that up, keep in mind, Chris and I have been working together on a lot of pieces over the past several years now. And we've seen five common themes to NGOs and some non-state actors. And there's five lessons. Number one, they evolve rapidly. They adapt. And even though a group, say, like Defend Europe, is going out on Sea Star and is having some hiccups, whether it's with media or whomever, every group can learn. They evolve or they die. Lesson number two is information operations can successfully support tactical advantages. They use OPSEC. They use military deception. Lesson number three, which Chris alluded to, is media engagement, manipulation, or exposure. It's a key element of any successful maritime issue, and we used to write about this a lot for, say, Sea Shepherd and some other ones. They know how to talk to the media and incorporate that to get their message across, to get more followers. Lesson number four is global operations are simply getting easier for maritime NGOs, even though they may initially be just localized or regional. Right now, most of these groups are largely regional. And fifth is that lawfare is a key component. They understand international law. They are working with attorneys. I can't say that as much for Defend Europe. I don't know what kind of infrastructure they have in Europe itself, but I do know the search and rescue NGOs are have really a superb capability right now in terms of infrastructure, in terms of raising their profile and awareness from their side of the issue as well. So there's a lot of very interesting aspects to this whole thing.
And Claude, you might be the one best to kick this off, but you know, let's talk a little bit about the NGOs, because when people say NGOs, for most people off the top of their head, they're going to think of Greenpeace or Sea Shepherd, uh-huh, or MSF, the your French is better than mine, the Doctors Without Borders is the English translation. So I'll let you do the French. Uh-huh. But there are a lot of new players out there, and we've talked a little bit about Defend Europe, but they're one group of mostly millennials from what I've been able to see. And you were able to dig up on some of their funding, $163,000 from 2,000 individual donors, which is not much money, but it's from a lot of people, a lot of small donors. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other players for NGOs wise that are out there helping the migrants move that people might not have heard before? And were you able to dig up anything on their funding, either individuals, corporations, or nations?
I'll actually turn that one over to Chris, because Chris put together the numbers originally for our first piece with War on the Rocks.
Yeah, the other groups have been successful to various degrees. I'd say there's a few big ones. Obviously, MSF is not a new organization. This Sea Rescue piece, I believe, is new. So they've got an established infrastructure with fundraising to leverage. There's some very small ones, single vessel NGOs, some of the ones that have just sprung up exclusively for this trend, and they're raising money in a variety of ways. So everything from the individual donors kind of crowdfunding to celebrity donations to affiliate links where they're selling products on their websites to you know, you name it, they're taking money. And that's, you know, one of the creative ways. Sea Shepherd has done very many similar things with the celebrity donations. The cause du jour tends to get attention, and certainly in Europe, this gets a lot more play than it does here in the U.S., which is one of the reasons that Claude and I decided to write about it in the naval sphere. But that it just varies, to answer your question. I mean, some of them have raised millions and millions of dollars. SOAS, probably the most popular or most one with a traction, they've actually done another campaign in the Andaman Sea, and that's that was just for one season because that migration route didn't last very long.
Well, but it all this does raise the question of, and I think you addressed it in one of your pieces and probably have said it here, but you know, these NGOs their mission seems to be for the most part to fill in gaps where they perceive government's not meeting a need, and in this case, the need of rescuing migrants who are being smuggled on these, often on unsafe vessels. Is there, and this is the, I guess, maybe the Defend Europe argument, is there a danger that by providing that kind of succor for these, for refugees, that they encourage more refugees to get underway in unsafe boats and cause further, you know, problems down the road for the for Europeans who may not want 30 million more people to migrate in?
Yeah, I think there's some validity in that, Eagle One. The if you see a path that is safe because you know that there's somebody across the sea, or you know, I just saw for the first time Bridge of Spies last night, and there's a scene where Tom Hanks' character, Jim Donovan, is going from East Germany to West Germany, and he's seeing these people trying to climb over the Berlin Wall in the early 1960s. And there's if you see somebody that's on top of the wall trying to pull you over, you're going to take a chance. But as we also saw in Bridge of Spies, a lot of those people were gunned down by the East Germans as they were trying to do so. And I think the danger is the more refugees that try to go by sea, the less likelihood is that they're going to encounter some of these, either the rescue SAR, the rescue NGOs, or other ships that may identify them. There's a, and that's not just in that region. You look at Somalia to Yemen. There have been a lot of attempts to cross the Gulf of Aden, and you hear just as many cases of ships that have turned over, capsized, and the people have been lost, or that people, that human traffickers were taking advantage of the situation. Now, to mitigate that, Italy has tried to work with the NGOs. They established a code of conduct earlier this year that they asked the NGOs to subscribe to. It had several parts to it. They wanted to tell them, don't enter Libyan waters. They wanted to inform them that you've got to keep on your AIS, your automatic identification system, and that hasn't always been the case. We can talk about the issues with AIS tactically and if you'd like. Regarding MRCC Rome, and that's become an issue because if there is a ship in distress, the MRCC Rome will find the closest ship to attend to the rescue. But also what they will do is direct that rescue ship to a particular port. So when Defend Europe, when I asked Defend Europe, you know, are, if you see a ship in distress, what happens? They said, oh, we're going to get them. We're going to save them. We'll also take them to Tunisia or Egypt or a non-European port. Well, the best of my understanding, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, MRCC Rome doesn't play that way. They only tell you where, which ports you can go to. And we've already started to see several ports that do not allow Defend Europe in port. There have been some protests by the locals to prevent them from entering port. Chris?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly all the dynamics on how ports are decided. There's a few major refugee camps, one on Sicily, and there's also refugee camps or migrant camps on the Libyan side that some of the NGOs, MSF especially, have presence at. As far as your initial question, I agree with Claude. There's certainly some validity. These organizations are reducing a risk to the vessels on this route. Are they encouraging human smuggling by being there and making the traffickers money? Maybe. Hard to say. That was the initial charter of the EU, was to try to counter the smuggling, and they destroy the rafts and that sort of thing. And some of these SAR groups have taken heat by the other side, or even by the governments of Italy and Libya, by not destroying some of the craft that these migrants are coming across on, because that obviously provides the vessel more opportunity for them to come across. And Claude mentioned the route across the Gulf of Aden from Somalia into Yemen. This past week, there was a report of a vessel sinking, and there was, I think, 80-something people on board and 50 of the Somalis and Ethiopians on board perished at sea. So I would imagine we'll see more coming through that route just because of the famine that's going on in East Africa at this point. And it'll be interesting to see if any of these organizations kind of put their money with their mouth, where their mouth is, and or vice versa, and take the chance of operating in the Gulf of Aden with all the other issues that are going on down there, if they're really concerned about protecting human life at sea.
And Chris, let's talk about that humanitarian impulse. You know, obviously, you've got to be careful painting broad brushes. And there are good people with good minds and good hearts and good desires, humanitarians, who are involved here. But I don't think, at least I haven't seen some really hard questioning of these people about the long term, you know, past the news cycle, past the year. And the the fourth paragraph of your article over on War on the Rocks, you, Claude, you know, dropped some numbers there and kept moving. But I think it's an important context for the listener to really to understand. You know, you're looking at over 1 million migrants are heading to Libya in Europe as their initial destination. And over at USNI blog last Wednesday, I put a little graph in a discussion I have where I link to your articles about the demographics of specifically sub-Saharan Africa over the next few decades. And it's just in an intensely aggressive curve. And you mentioned it in your article that as many as 30 million Africans may migrate to Europe in the next decade. If you use as a rough outline who these people are, they're mostly military-aged young males with no education moving into a high-technology, high-knowledge economy part of the world. And 30 million. 30 million is the equivalent of the present-day populations of Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg combined, or for those that really want to look at a geographical footprint, if you took the present-day population of all the Swedish and Baltic countries besides Poland, we're talking Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. That's all less than 30 million people. Amongst these humanitarian NGOs, do they have any appreciability or understanding of the sustainability of this influx, not only from an economic point of view, but from a cultural conflict point of view in the destination countries? Or are they so focused on grabbing the next person with a life vest that they're just not getting the big picture?
Yeah, you'd probably have to ask them that. So I have doubts. It's interesting. There's a lot of nuanced language involved here. Migrant versus refugee. Most of the SAR groups are going to say these folks are refugees. A lot of people will say that they're migrants. Looking at my Africa map on the wall here, a lot of these people, as you said, come from sub-Saharan Africa, specifically places like Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria. These are, as Africa goes, I spend a lot of time in that part of Africa. As Africa goes, these countries are doing much better than they have been in the past. That said, there's obviously a lack of economic opportunity for these military-age males, as you said. You can certainly see why. Well, I don't know. It's challenging for me to see why someone would not want to leave Somalia and go to a place like Yemen, but that's happening as well. Maybe it's just because there's some modicum of food there. It's not necessarily because they're treated well when they get there. So it's interesting. One of the things I was thinking about this morning, there's sort of an analogous situation in our own history on a much smaller scale in the 1990s. There was it was not, you know, it's post the Mariel boat lift, but there was a Cuban migration. There was a Cuban exile group called Brothers to the Rescue, and they started out with boats rescuing these migrants as they came across the Florida Straits there. And then they began to they found it more efficient and operationally sound to fly these little Cessnas as observation planes, and then they would cue the Coast Guard, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard would come rescue these migrants. And that all culminated in 1996 when a MiG-29 from Cuba shot down one of these Cessnas, and obviously that kind of put a damper on their operations. But it's just goes to show these things kind of come and go, and this is not the only place we've seen this sort of back and forth with these NGOs related to migration.
Yeah, and just to add on to Chris, I don't know about the SAR NGOs. I think they're concern is more immediate. That's their mission. That is what they are raising money for. I don't think they're looking 5 or 10 years down the line. And that's why I think Kaplan had talked about this great population shift. What I don't think Defend Europe is looking at is this. They are trying to stop, say, whether it's illegal trafficking, illicit trafficking, or even if they are trying to stop migrants at sea, the horse has left the barn at this point. What they're not looking at are the raw numbers. You can get them from The Economist. You can get them from, any legitimate statistical source, when you look at the replacement birth rates for most West European countries, you know, it's below that 2.0 mark in Spain and France, et cetera, whereas the migrant populations are exploding with in birth rates there. So what you're going to have is that major shift, regardless. You could, Defend Europe could stop migrant shifts by sea today, and it wouldn't make a difference. And I don't think they're thinking that way. It's just like the same thing here in the United States with each immigration wave. You know, my grandparents were all from French Canada, and both sides came from, 10 kids, 12 kids. It was simply that's how it was for immigrants. And today there's a city in my home state where 30 years ago there really weren't any migrants, and today 60% of the elementary school system is composed of East African migrants. So from a primarily French, Irish, Greek community, it is now completely shifted. So I don't think people tend to look 10, 20, 30 years down the road on many issues, and that's why we're trying to look at what's happening today.
Yeah, the United Nations Refugee Committee, whatever it is, the UNHCR, has a really good webpage, which I put up on the chat room here a minute ago. But, you know, they've said that since January of 2017, 118,523 people have arrived by sea, and of those, almost 97,000 end up in Italy. And I guess from Italy being EU, they can go forward somewhere. But and I noticed that the Italians have been much more proactive in addressing some of these issues, trying to work with the Libyan. I guess there's a bifurcated Libyan government right now. And when the
yes.
Italians said we're going to go down and patrol your coast, one part of the bifurcation said, if you do that, we're going to attack you. I don't know how realistic that was either, but the Libyans don't want to be stuck with all these people, and so is there a place for the UN or some other group to say, okay, look, we've got this problem. These people want to migrate. We're getting 14% of these people now are from Nigeria. And we're really losing the bubble on the war refugees. Is there a group that could say we've got to do better than this and figure out where a good resting spot for some of these migrants would be? Or is that, because we're leaving it right now to individual nations, which some of whom are voting against opening up more ports to the migrants through the EU?
I think the broader issue is a political issue that you're asking about, and not simply, what Chris and I have been trying to focus on the maritime aspect. And I don't know who or what is going to try to tackle this. I mean, there are a lot of European leaders who have been criticized, who have been supported, depending on what they're doing. But that's really been beyond the scope of our work.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of intergovernmental organizations in the EU, the EU, NATO, and many others. The efficacy of those groups is up for debate in this handling this issue.
No, I think we'll
let me follow up on that.
Oh, go ahead.
Let me follow up on that for a second, because we've got an issue of, you're talking about maritime law here to a certain extent, the responsibility to save people in distress on the sea. But, is there an obligation to allow people, and I'm not aware of one personally, but is there an obligation to allow people to migrate freely through national borders?
Well, I think there are going to be people who say, yes, we should have open borders. And that issue has come up at time and time again in political discussions. And there are going to be people who say, no, we need to close the borders. The question is, who is in power to determine what's going to happen? But I just don't know how much they're looking into each issue other than in American politics, I can tell you, having worked on Capitol Hill and on a number of political campaigns, you tend to be as brief as possible. You almost speak in Twitter speak on your policy issues, because that's what's understood, and you don't have to invest a lot in conveying your message.
Yeah, I got nothing to add to that. That's exactly right.
I think the interesting thing before Italy took action, it was pretty modest action, is a fleet of NGOs out there is a primary indicator of a failure of not just the international community, but individual nations who, I think, especially in Europe, they thought they joined the EU and a longer term extent the UN, that these large international problems that would tend to export themselves would be taken care of by these extranational organizations. And there's just been a broad failure of leadership, which is what the smart money betted on anyway. And so NGOs will step into that gap until somebody makes even a modest effort to go forward. And that kind of clears the deck for a certain extent, which I think is an interesting story in and to itself. The larger desire for governments to do their job. But as the NGOs were going at each other, what I found interesting, and Claude, you mentioned it a little bit ago, lawfare. As C-Star was trying to make their way west, there was a series of events that I guess harassment's one way to look at it, but tripping them up, making life difficult for them, for people that knew international law and knew how to do it. Talk a bit how these competing NGOs are going into another area traditionally reserved for state actors, and that's lawfare in an international sense to either interfere or to open opportunities for themselves.
Sure. In terms of C-Star, it obviously had to transit when it came up through the Red Sea, it had to go through Egypt, and it was first stopped just before she arrived in the Med. There were reports at that time whether or not they had armed guards aboard. There were questions about whether or not they had weapons, and Chris and I have sort of debunked any idea like that the cost is simply too prohibitive for a small organization to have armed guards aboard. It just wasn't – it didn't pass the smell test for us. But by the same token, if something like that comes up, and even here in the United States, somebody accuses you of something, you've got to get a lawyer. You've got to, the onus on you to defend yourself. And the same thing was true of Defend Europe. They then approached Cyprus, and they were stopped again. There was an issue with individuals who were aboard the ship and whether or not they were being transported to eventually make their way to Europe. I think there were about 20 Sri Lankans, if I'm not mistaken. The folks from C-Star suggested that they were apprentice sailors, I believe, and they didn't have papers. Five of them were eventually requested and were offered asylum. Then there were counter claims by Defend Europe that no, these individuals were offered money by the SAR NGO. So, it was this real tennis court effect of the ball going back and forth. But tactically, what it did is it certainly delayed C-Star, and it definitely put a hamper on a no-drama transit. And so we saw this earlier a few years ago with the second Gaza flotilla. And Chris and I mentioned this in the piece as well, is, after the first failed issue with the first Gaza flotilla, it was entering the Israeli Defense Force boarded the ship. It was a PR disaster. The next approach they took was to try to talk to the insurers and to, I think it was Inmarsat, and try to delegitimize the organization so that they couldn't get underway. Because when you get underway, you have to have insurance, you have to have the right paperwork, you have to have, communications. Well, there's ways of going back to folks, and that's what happened also with C-Star, because the SAR NGOs realized, wait a minute, they're raising money through, I think it was PayPal and another. Sorry, I'm blanking on the second one. Patreon. Patreon. Thank you very much. So what they did is they went to PayPal. They said, hey, look, defend Europe. They're alt-right racists. They're going to threaten the people in distress. They're not going there to help. And so PayPal issued that statement that Defend Europe published and said, hey, look, this is why we can no longer use PayPal. So that was a way of eliminating that way of raising money. Now, they did eventually find other ways. But it's these kind of tactics that were used not only by Israel with the Gaza flotilla, but now we're starting to see with the NGOs, and I can see that proliferating as well.
Yeah, on the adaptability piece that Claude and I often talk about regarding these groups, it's interesting. They definitely had some missteps, as one would expect on any kind of first out the gate mission, with the failure to secure any sort of diplomatic clearance to refuel in Tunisia. It looks like they had mechanical difficulties one day last week where they were DIW for, I don't know, maybe a 24-hour period or something, and flying not under command signals. But I think that on the lawfare piece, what's interesting is that they're registered in Mongolia, and here's a landlocked country that's had this registration process for a decade or so. And they are they've actually taken some heat for it. So I just find it a little curious that that's where they chose to register. Whereas if you look at most of the other NGO ships, they're all flagged out of England with a couple of exceptions. I meant Europe.
Sorry. Yeah, and Amsterdam is actually a really good place for NGOs to be based out of. There's at least four or five that I can think of off the top of my head, because the Dutch laws are more permissive and welcoming of that sort of activism. And I want to add on, it's not just that. It's one of the other tactics that they're using is AAS. We just saw a report that Russia may be testing a spoofing capability for AIS to make things difficult for ships that are using that or may try to follow it. I mean, I know that Chris and I have been following the ships using a variety of online tools like Marine Traffic, VesselFinder.com, et cetera, which all use primarily AIS for tracking ships. So we can kind of see what they're doing, what kind of maneuvers, what time it's taking them. But at some points, we've also seen some of the NGOs suddenly appear 30 miles inland. I've talked to one of the other maritime NGOs who have long standing and who said that they've used this before to make it appear like they're somewhere else. So the whole issue of AIS, which is really fundamental to navigation at sea for ships of a certain tonnage, is being called into question now as well and being used as a means of deception.
Yeah, I thought it was really useful that you guys put in the SIMSEC piece, the flags of the countries involved in all the operations, which includes, Luxembourg, which, as I recall, is landlocked. But, and that raises the question of a much more global question with regard to NGOs, including Sea Shepherd and some of the other ones. You know, they are flagged, but the flags that they are flagged by exert little or no control over the actions of their flagged ships. Is that one of those issues that, outside of just the Mediterranean, needs to be addressed globally by people interested in trying to gain, I think, what Urbina calls the outlaw sea? Is this some way to help rein in some of these activities?
Yeah, that's a good point, Eagle One. Ian Urbina's Outlaw Ocean was an outstanding piece of investigative journalism. And one of the problems that he's found, and one of those that all of us who have been to sea, Chris and I and you and Salamander, we see these flags of convenience because the ships don't have to be as concerned with certain regulations as they would be if they were U.S. flagged or French flagged, et cetera. And why you'll see these small countries that are either landlocked or really have no Navy international presence to speak of, like Panama, are far more enabling of sort of the cheaper side of shipping. It's simply a matter of cost. And that probably should be something that the international community looks at, because that's happened not only with the NGOs, it's happened with non-state actors, it's happened with the private maritime security companies, although some of the legitimate ones were finding legitimate flags, etc. Chris? And Chris just might have dropped off. Go ahead, Sal.
Yeah, Eagle, let me see if I can get Chris back on the line if you wanted to take the con here for a minute.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about private maritime security companies. And have we set are we setting a precedent that we really don't want to have in allowing? I mean, I don't know who's going to control this stuff, but it's always been the danger to the private maritime security companies. There was no accountability. There was no way to go back to them other than and track them down and punish them if things went awry. That was one of the Strait of Malacca's country's big concern. Is there an issue here too with the with these NGOs that are quote helping or they're either abetting these illegal immigration, or they're really out there rescuing people who desperately need it? Is that lack of accountability an issue?
I'm going to correct you on part of that, because with regard to the private maritime security companies, they were in to a degree self-regulating. There was an organization, SAMI, that emerged for the security industry at sea that tried to set some standards that you could go to discuss some of these things. And even, the private security companies themselves had various forms of legitimacy and of quality, just as you would. I mean, I think I've used the term before, go to New York for a five-star restaurant or a meal at a side cart on the street. You're going to get different levels of service, of the quality of the food, et cetera. It was the same with the private security companies. And eventually what happened was, these guys talked to each other, the armed security guys from around the world, and they knew which companies to gear toward, and they knew which ones to stay away from. And I think that's the same case with the NGOs. They have had an opportunity now with the Italian Code of Conduct, the Italian Code of Conduct that they set to participate. And one of the things I didn't mention with that Code of Conduct that came out earlier this year is it said, look, the Italians wanted to have law enforcement aboard once they reached Italian waters, I think it was. And the purpose for that was so they could really get a sense of who the migrants were. Now, there was one NGO that did not comply and did not want to have anybody aboard, and this might be going back into the mindset of, do we trust the government enough to help us, or is this law enforcement individual coming aboard to remove us from the job that we intend to do that we don't see them doing? So there's a real question mark. It would make sense to cooperate with local authorities to ensure that. But you can see some of the reluctance happening even within the NGOs. I mean, there are some NGOs that quite simply are, not borderline anarchists, but they have a distrust of government. And we saw that in the 2016 election. You saw that from both sides. You saw the Sanders supporters who were largely hesitant about Hillary's candidacy, and you saw that on the Republican side with regard to Trump's rise, and a lot of folks who didn't trust the standard Washington players, the Bushes and the Clintons, et cetera, and that filtered down. So you see that here, even here in the United States, is that inherent distrust of government. Whether it's right or wrong, it's simply something that exists.
Yeah, I'll add to the first part that I agree with Claude that these private maritime security groups have shown discernment. At least the ones that have survived, several of them came and went during the height of the Somali piracy crisis. The same goes with the ship owners. Many of these, I'd probably say most of the vessels that are being used by these NGOs are under charter. So to a certain extent, people are out there doing what people do, what business owners do is making money. So it's, I don't know how many of these ships, it would be interesting to see how many of these ships are being run by the NGOs themselves, or how many are being operated by some sort of charter crew. I'm quite positive that Defend Europe is being chartered, and
yes,
I don't think, like Claude said, it's you know, six or eight European guys in polo shirts are the crew, the volunteers, the activists, and then there's professional mariners that are actually driving the vessel on some sort of day rate.
Going forward, and I guess because you dropped off, Chris, we're going to punish you by having you answer this question first. Let's look forward for a bit, because something Claude mentioned in his previous answer kind of put a spark into my head, because we've talked on and off about how Italy has started to take some action. And it's amazing what happens when a first world nation parks a warship off your port. It squeezes that part of the balloon, but the balloon goes elsewhere. And unrelated, but it helped tell a story. There's a great video out there of a beautiful beach scene in Spain, where all of a sudden this big boat looks like a World War II amphibious landing comes ashore, and dozens of sub-Saharan African migrants jump out and then run into town. Just an amazing scene that outlines where we're going here. That even if the other border nations, Spain especially, but also Greece and France, even if they decided that they wanted to move forward and try to stop it, you're going to have those NGOs that have a different worldview and see as their job is to get those people anyway. So we know what's happened. We know how it's morphed. But where do you see this ongoing story developing? Which direction do you see it developing over the course of the next 6 to 12 months that people should keep an eye on?
Yeah, I personally think that we're going to see the Libyan exert more influence over their sovereign territorial waters, as they should, as they were when Gaddafi was in power. Not to necessarily endorse a dictator, but that tends to keep the migration from originating, at least out of Libya. You know, there's other places they're coming from: Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, even Egypt. And those all have destination points that are different. Obviously, on the west side, you're talking Spain. On the east side, you're talking Cyprus, maybe even into Turkey and then back up to Greece. So that's part of the equation. The other part of the equation is the land routes. I mean, people talk about this arduous sea routes, but, I mean, these guys that are coming from Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire and places like that are essentially crossing the Sahara. So, I mean, by the time they get to Libya, they're pretty beat down. So I think you have to look at that side as well, all the push-pull factors. And you also have to look at, you know, the information side of this. It'll be interesting to see that if the Libyans and the Italians prevent these migrants from getting across the Med, does that news get back to these sort of supply countries, and does that just kind of frustrate them and either cause them to, you know, try to go a different way or just stay where they are? That's can't give you a crystal ball prediction, but I can just kind of tell you some of the factors involved.
Yeah, I'd largely agree with Chris on that one. Right now you're seeing four of the SAR NGOs, which are in Valletta, Malta, as we speak. I think we'll probably see a growth of security along the Libyan border simply because they have to. This is going to be somebody asserting their own power, and you can't prove that you're a leader of a country or a leader of a region of a country without being able to secure your border. So I think that you're going to see that from Libya, and now you're starting to see more action from Italy as well.
Well, I think this – I want to thank both of you guys for raising this issue, because, you know, the whole NGO at sea aspect of things is fascinating. Legally, it's you know, unknown territory in a lot of ways, at least to me. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about it because, as you've already noted, I mean, here's a classic situation of NGOs in conflict in the sense of, you know, what they're trying to do, and the, all the things you just labeled. I mean, it is like warfare, information warfare, comms, you got it all. It's and lawfare. So I think it's a really important issue. I'm glad you guys are on it, and I suspect we'll hear a lot more about it. And as we're getting ready to wrap up the show, let me ask you both what we can we'll be looking forward to seeing from you here in the near future.
Well, now that I've finished the final edits on my dissertation and getting ready to send it off for defense in the spring or winter, I'm going to be returning to the third Connor Stark novel, but I'll also another article idea that I've got.
Yeah, I'm not really writing anything. I'm really entrenched in my civilian and Navy jobs, but sooner or later, Claude and I will write something else on this topic.
Absolutely, and I got to say that, let me add this for Sal and Eagle One. I think a writing partnership can be really difficult. Chris and I encountered one another at first on Twitter many, many years ago, accidentally, when we were commenting on the show Whale Wars by Sea Shepherd. We later communicated with each other. We've met, and I got to say, it's been a great working partnership. We really throw ideas at each other, and so what you're really seeing is the synthesis of our work and cooperation on that. So I want to thank Chris for just being a great writing partner on these issues.
Likewise, Claude.
I'll just join the man bro hug fest. Y'all have done some great work here, I look forward to seeing other writing your part. And for the listeners, if y'all would like to cyberstalk Claude and Chris like I do on Twitter, it's at CG Berube. And of course, you can find Chris at Naval Drones. And gentlemen, thank you again. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And as my co-host said, really appreciate y'all shedding light on not just an interesting but an important topic that's not going to be going anywhere anytime soon. And hope y'all have a great rest of the month.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRat. Until next time, we hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Yep. Eagle One and Sal, we off.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.